Playing well, as I mentioned, Michael Akumia will join me, and Scott Gillen has also joined me now. Penty Jijo is also on Zoom. Let me just touch base with the guys now, and let's see. Hello, guys. I hope you can hear me. Hello, Penty. Hello, Scott. Scott.
I was
back.
Wonderful, wonderful.
Glad I can hear me.
I can hear you, Penty. Wonderful. Good to have you. And Scott, I hope you're well too. Are you still in the States?
No, I'm back. I'm back in the UAE at the moment. Sadly, not able to enjoy any more of the World Cup, but it was good to get over there for a bit.
Yeah, wonderful. It's been a really good tournament so far, really. How was your experience, though? Did it live up to your expectations?
Yeah, it did. I was cautious about whether it would feel like there was a World Cup on. Obviously, as big as football/soccer is over there, it was a question of how big it would feel in some of those cities. But obviously, with the stadiums often being located quite some way outside of the main cities, I was interested to see how much it felt like a World Cup. But it really did. There was a great atmosphere around. I was quite fortunate. And my first city was Toronto in Canada, where there was Ghana fans, Panama fans, some Germans appeared, and some Ivory Coast fans as well. And then Boston, there was the English, Scottish, French, Norwegians, Ghanaians, great mix of fans. And yeah, it was a very a really, really enjoyable atmosphere, actually. So yeah, can't speak highly enough of the experience.
Wonderful, really good one there. And Penty. Of course, I've watched the tournament with you here in Ghana, but have you enjoyed it? Just if you're watching on the screen, have you enjoyed it? Or Black Stars exit has sort of took the joy away from you, Penty?
Oh, it has been a great tournament. I've enjoyed every bit of it so far. A lot of excitement, a lot of goals, and definitely some of these African teams have disappointed us, but some, like Morocco, have really proven to be a very good team on the continent and has shown that on the world stage, and we are happy about it. Despite being knocked out in the quarterfinals, I'm really happy about their performance. In all, it's been a great tournament so far. I think the teams that we expect them to do well at this tournament are doing well, and for me, it's just bring the excitement, and it's been a great tournament so far. I really enjoy how the big players have also stepped up, the likes of Harry Kane, Kylian Mbappe, Lionel Messi. All the stars are stepping out to the equation, and that's what we want. That's the kind of entertainment we enjoy, and it has been a great World Cup so far.
Wonderful. Really, really great. We'll get to talk about those briefly, but it's interesting you mentioned Morocco. And Scott, I want to come to that conversation about the performance of African teams in the competition. Senegal, of course, following the exit, they have now parted ways with Papi Thiaw. For Morocco, they were received really well when they arrived. Likewise, Egypt, they were received really well. And it appears that and Cape Verde also were received really well when they arrived. Will you say Cape Verde were probably the African team that surprised you the most? Because even for Morocco, it was quite understandable. Looking at what they did in 2022, I'm sure they would have hoped to, at the very least, meet that very benchmark of a semi-final berth. But, you can talk about their case. But for Cabo Verde, though, playing the tournament for the very first time and how they distinguished themselves, I'm sure they are one of the African sides that you were truly proud of.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So a really interesting one, isn't it? Because they unlike some of their peers, they didn't actually have the benefit of the African Cup of Nations to sort of prepare and play a higher volume of matches coming into the tournament. And I think on that basis, there was a question on my mind as to whether they would come into the tournament and show the quality that we've seen them demonstrate on the African continent. Perhaps they slightly slipped off in the qualifying for the African Cup of Nations, obviously the same way as Ghana had done. But they just looked such a cohesive side, and obviously there was a great story with Rosinha as well, and I think that was potentially quite inspiring. they scored some amazing goals. That the goal against against Argentina to equalise was honestly extraordinary, particularly given the context. And I thought they were such a joy to watch because they didn't really change their principles much. Yes, they were defending more than they might have done when they played some matches on the continent, but they still played with such attacking verve. And they were so well organised defensively, they were very clear in their principles. I just thought it was a really impressive performance. And I think, you know, a lot of the talk in this tournament has been about African coaches, maybe, particularly Papadiao, as to whether his coaching led to Senegal being less than the sum of their parts. I think there's been a similar discussion about Ghana at times. Questions about, you know, for example, Tunisia. There's been discussions about the quality of coaching of the African sides, but I think certainly the Cabo Verde, certainly Egypt, Morocco. I think, you know, they really showed that there's really high standard of coaching on the continent, and it's probably just people latching onto specific examples. I don't think there's a signs of a trend, but it's really pleasing that the Cabo Verde in particular really showed, you know, what a well-coached, highly motivated, attackingly varied side can look like. And yeah, it was great to see them and great to see the joy of all their fans and actually how the world embraced them as well, because I think so many people used Cape Verde as an example of why the 48-team competition was a bad idea. And it was so great that they came in and showed that they absolutely belonged at the World Cup.
Well, really, really good. Really good there. And Petty, it's quite interesting. If you look at even after the tournament, so Senegal have parted ways with their coach. You know, for Tunisia, Hervé Renard was obviously going to leave because of the duration of his contract. So he's out. Morocco are still keeping their coach. South Africa, Hugo Broos has indicated that, well, he's going to leave the job. And for Ivory Coast, I don't think they have changed their manager. You can correct me if I'm wrong. And Egypt, likewise, I don't think they're going to part ways with Hussein Hassam. He's done a pretty decent job for them. I think Algeria are likely to part ways with their coach. Not too sure. Let's see how that ends out. But will you say maybe, indeed, the African coaches distinguished themselves pretty well at this tournament? Or it was just a deja vu, sort of, Penty?
For me, I think with the number of participants you have from Africa, you would expect us to do well. And I think we've proven to be one of the continents that could produce some of the best teams. And Morocco have distinguished themselves, and they make it all the way to the quarterfinals. But if you look at the disparity between Morocco or the difference in the gap in quality between Morocco and the other teams, you can see that is very big, and that is concerning, because then you have Morocco playing so well and there is Ghana that is playing not so well. Like the gap is too big, and you could see with Egypt, Senegal leading 2 goals, and with 10 minutes to go, with 20 minutes to go, with 5 minutes to go, they collapse and the other teams capitalize and win. It's just so bad for the image of African football. But that being said, this is the first time some of these players are playing at this level. And as time goes on, if Africa gets the nod with more teams, these countries and these players will have more experiences at the world stage, because there was no way Cape Verde would have been at this year's World Cup if the slot or the opportunity has not been given to Africa to present at least 9 teams. So that is a major, major boost for Africa. And if you look at how these teams have taken the opportunity and making the most of it, Cape Verde can make a good case for anybody who looks down upon Africa or any other continent presenting more teams. So
but if you look at Penty, if you look at how the coaches even manage some of the games that their teams were involved in, some of them have come under heavy criticism. For instance, Papa Thiaw and explains why he has now been sacked, if you want to call it. And it's because of how he managed the game in the Ivory Coast one, also how the coach managed the game, even in the game in the Egypt one, how they managed the game. Most of the African sides, especially the coaches, have come under some criticism for how they manage the games. Do you think these criticisms are fair, and or it's you just consider this as just a learning curve of a sort?
You could argue that it's a fair criticism, but because you look at the Egypt team, for example, it's a very young squad. Some of these players have not even played at a major tournament like the World Cup. And when we talk about African football, it's not just about the talent, it's also about the mentality of the players. You could say the coach has a huge role to play in changing that mentality or managing the game. But at the same time, experience at that level would count, because you make the right substitutions. We saw it when Sene Lammens was at a huge fault for Belgium's goal, right? He doesn't have the experience that Courtois has. Even though he plays for Manchester United, that's the first time he's playing at a World Cup. That could be a disadvantage. So even though the coaches, we could blame Papetiao, we could blame MS Fair, we could blame, but Hussein Hassan did so well. I don't see anything wrong with the substitutions or the tactical approach. It's just that it was unfortunate because Chaubert, who was one of the best players in that first half, could not stop a point blank going short anymore because he's so tired. And that is not a tactical switch. You can't do a tactical switch to... It's too much on Chaubert. And that is what I'm talking about. The experience at that level counts. And I think as more and more of these players get opportunities to play at the highest level, we'll see more, because I feel like Morocco, most of their players are playing the 2022 World Cup, were in this World Cup as well. The rise of Hakimi, Amrabat, the goalkeeper Bono was there, and they went to the semifinals. They brought the same crop of players into the mix, even though they changed their coach. You get it. So a new coach is in the helm of affairs, but they are doing so because the core of the team is there. They have the experience at the highest level. Hakimi plays for PSG. Bruno, one of the best goalkeepers in the world. If you could see that kind of quality and experience at the highest level, it will go to your advantage. So I just have a feeling, or I just want to side with the people that would say it's a learning curve and it is not so much on the managers, yeah.
Okay, great. Scott, do you agree with this? You know, submission there by Penty, that look, let's not be too harsh on the African coaches. Let me just mention that Michael Akumia has joined us now, and we've got very limited time with Scott, so let me just try and maximize that. Then, but Scott, I mean, what do you make of this conversation surrounding the performance of African coaches? At the tournament.
Yeah, I mean, I think when teams go out, there's always going to be criticism of the coach. I suspected England not got the result against Norway, there would have been significant criticism of Thomas Tuchel last night. As it is, he's a genius again. I think in some cases, quality rises to the top. I think when you talk about kind of late goals and the management of matches, for example, the England match against DR Congo, Harry Kane scored an incredible goal, even though the Congo defence looked well set. Sometimes you can't beat elite talent. And I think Egypt, Argentina, I think is a similar example of sometimes elite footballers find a way. And it's a credit to the coaches of those teams. It's a credit to the Morocco coach. It's a credit to the coach of the Ivory Coast at times as well. For example, how well they did against Germany, that they were in position to win those matches. And obviously at times, and on a number of occasions, that they weren't able to get over the line. But I think kind of game management, it's such a nuanced conversation. It's often heavily driven by the result. But I think in a number of cases, I thought the game management that the coach showed was actually quite good. And their decision making seemed logical. It was joined up. Sometimes they were forced into making changes because of injuries. But I thought, broadly speaking, I think African coaches and African teams can be very, very proud of themselves. This tournament, as Penty said, I think Africa showed it's a continent that can produce competitive sides that challenge and have reached the last 32, that reached the last 16, and can compete with nations that are looking to go on, and indeed are going deep into this tournament. So I'd say overall, I think that there has to be a lot of positives for Africa. And I think, you know, they're talking about a 60-team competition. And I would like to think that CAF will receive serious consideration for a good chunk of those additional spots, because, you know, when you compare the performance of the CAF nations to the nations from Asia, to the nations from kind of Australasia, and indeed from CONCACAF, I think CAF really stood out in terms of the quality of its teams, in terms of the tactical variety of its teams, in terms of the intensity of its teams, and in terms of the ability of its teams to really take the game to some of the favourites at this competition. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing how things develop in the next few years, obviously with a look forward to 2030.
Really interesting there, Scott. Let me bring Michael now in. Michael, good to have you. Really, really good to have you. And just get your thoughts on this African representation at the tournament, the performance of the coaches in particular. We've just seen the latest casualty in Papi Thiaw, Senegal coach, being shown the exit door. Overall, what will be your assessment of the coaches?
I think it all boils down to game management and how they see out games. Their thinking and their strategy to close out games in specific moments. So, for example, you look at the substitutions by Hossam Hassan prior to the end of the game against Egypt and Argentina. Then you would understand that he's a coach that needs to learn more during certain stages of the game and how he can react to how opponents set up, because that was one game I felt like at 2-2 or maybe at 2-1, there was no need to just maybe sub on other players to come in terms of your attack, but just to sit back, be very compact, introduce more defenders, leave your two main attackers up front, and let's see how things work out. But he decides to open it up, try and play with Argentina, concedes again, making it 2-2. Then he opens it up again, goes for the third goal, and then he loses the game. So these are the little details when it comes to how some of these African coaches cope with pressure when there's a need for them to step up tactically, and how it can reflect on the mentality of these players. The same thing also happened with Papi Thiaw. I think where Senegal lost the game was the substitution of Papi Gueye. Certain changes can affect the psychological nature of teams. So, for example, when we used to play football in our areas, you know that this is a very key player in your setup. The moment the substitution board goes up and everything clearly shows that he's going out, most of us begin to ask questions. Hey, what is happening? We can't win this game. It plays into the psychological aspect in terms of how we want to see out the game. And definitely, it plays out many a times. So when you look at a player like Papi Gueye playing so well, then you look at him and you say, okay, my guy, you need to move out of the team. We need to sub. You need to bring in another player. And these players start questioning you and began to ask themselves questions that we can't see out this game, and it definitely reflects on the results. I think there is a need for a lot of them to learn on the job. Most of them, where they've grown up, where they came up from, how they handle the teams, the strategy they use, the mode they use to acquire these positions, where they came from, all of these things will need a lot of experience to master it. So MSFI, he was an assistant coach. He was promoted to become the head coach of the Ivorian national team, won the African Cup of Nations. But there is more he needs to learn on the game. The same as Hossam Hassan, no matter how experienced he is playing, where he has gone to, there's a lot he needs to learn. Then look at Papi Thiaw. So I was not surprised that they needed to do away with Papi Thiaw at some point in time, because that performance at the World Cup with the kind of quality they have and the squad management, that was very abysmal, and they should have done better than what they did. They were even saved at a point in time with the third best place team kind of bit. But I think they did not even capitalize on that opportunity to make sure that at the end of the day, they can fight 2-10-0 to maintain themselves in their quest to make the quarterfinals or the semifinals of the World Cup.
Really great. Great submission there. Well, let's talk about the where we've gotten to now. It's Spain versus France. It's Argentina versus England. And Scott, let me bring you in on this one. At the start of the tournament, was this something you expected? Were these the four semi-finalists you seriously tipped at the start of the tournament?
Yeah, there were four offer teams. As an Englishman, I was pretty worried about the English route via Mexico and the potential to play Brazil or Norway. The reality is that there have been plenty of good teams at this tournament. But these are the top four seeds. And I think on paper, when you look at them in terms of the quality of their players, when you look at the quality of their coaches as well, these four probably are the most complete sides of the tournament. I've seen people sort of just saying that the France-Spain semi-final is more like a final, with those two kind of being head and shoulders above England and Argentina. I don't quite agree with that, but I can certainly see why that's a view. I think at this point, it's clear that France are the strongest side of the competition. They've been the most complete. They seem to have the most solutions to problems because of the just immense quality they have, particularly in the attacking third. But they also have, great variety in terms of their midfielders. We haven't even seen N'Golo Kanté yet, and they can do kind of various different things defensively. So France are such a tremendous side, and it's going to take something special for someone to win. It's possible that Spain and the way Spain play, the way that they've defended with the ball throughout this tournament, I think Unai Simon has perhaps faced a dozen shots, if not slightly fewer, this tournament on target, which shows how well they've defended. But I think the defending with the ball is such a key part of that in terms of how they possess the ball. I think that's going to be a fascinating match, and because I think Morocco tried to take the sting out of France by possessing the ball and trying to get France to have to press them. And obviously Spain can do that and have been doing that, the Spanish players, since they were 10, 11 years old. So that's going to be fascinating. And then obviously on the other side of the draw, England-Argentina, a tremendous rivalry, and just tremendously kind of different, versatile teams. Argentina is so good at playing through the middle of the pitch. Their diamond that they've used recently, the way that they progress the ball, the way that the players play in the small spaces in the pockets, and obviously the game-breaking quality of Messi versus England, who are such a dynamics team, looking to progress in the wide areas, play kind of over long spaces at high speeds. It's really a clash of styles that could go either way. And it's going to be fantastic to watch the semi-finals because they're going to be intriguing tactical battles. But also, to Penty's point earlier, that so many of the big-name players who play for those teams have turned up with this World Cup. There's so many of those players are in form. So there's going to be tremendous individual and personal battles as well. It's really exciting. And I think FIFA got the semi-finals they wanted. And it's going to be great to watch.
Yeah, I mean, just talking about the individual players and how some of them are really going to turn up in that game, it leads me to the England game against Norway. Strangely, Thomas Tuchel, despite the shift the players put in, he did recognise that, look, they had to work really hard, but he was not impressed with the quality of football they played. And that's something that some of the players found surprising. Madueke was left surprised when he was told by the reporters that, well, his coach said they were lucky. Likewise, Jude Bellingham. And he said, well, he has no idea how it was like to play against Norway. I mean, do you agree with Thomas Tuchel to some extent that, look, although the team won the game against Norway, but against Argentina, they absolutely will have to improve a lot. And if that's the case, what were the things that you sort of noticed England were deficient in that game against Norway?
Yeah, I think Thomas Tuchel wasn't unfair. I think he got a bit misquoted to the two players, which was probably more unfair. I think the things that he picked out probably was firstly in the first half, England's speed of tempo in possession, but you can completely understand that that's something that might not be at its highest if it's sort of 40 degrees Celsius, feels like 40 degrees Celsius weather because of the heat and humidity. And England were kind of, they had a lot of quite sterile possession, passing the ball around in front of Norway's block without really penetrating, but then didn't look that defensively secure either. And then when Tuchel tried to accelerate things in the second half, he brought on Eberechi Eze, played Jude Bellingham slightly deeper. England were then really chaotic. They weren't making the right pass. They were at times playing too safe, at times playing too risky. It felt like they were quite nervous. There was some inaccuracy in the things they were doing. Players weren't kind of gambling when they should have done at the back post, things like that. There was a real lack of fluency. And so I can see that Thomas Tuchel would be annoyed about that. And they will certainly have to improve. They'll have to improve the accuracy, I think, against Argentina. Because obviously Argentina have the types of players that can kill you. And if you are a bit sloppy in central areas and you turn the ball over, as England did on a handful of occasions, actually, I think Argentina have got the players to really make you pay in those moments. But equally, I think, you know, Argentina do pose slightly different challenges to Norway. I think in the first half we saw Tuchel was struggling with the fact that his right back was a centre back and Declan Rice was, by all accounts, has been in bed for the last week, or since they played Mexico with some sort of sickness. So he was playing deeper, and I think it just affected England's offensive unpredictability, their offensive sort of tempo and speed. And they were also a bit cautious because of Erling Haaland. And I think Argentina, although they have Messi, I think his threat is so different from Haaland. And indeed, Argentina's counter-attacking threat, from an English perspective, is probably not as significant as Ghana's was, as the DR Congo's threat, as Mexico's threat, and indeed as Norway's threat. So I think it's going to be interesting how Tuchel kind of does the trade-off between how many players he wants deep protecting against the counter and circulating possession, how many players he trusts to kind of bomb forwards. Because the other aspect is, I think the average height of the Argentina team is something like 5'10", 5'11", whereas the average height of the England team is sort of 6'1", 6'2". And that obviously has a big difference in terms of defending crosses and so on. So it's going to be a real chess match, how the teams manage their respective deficiencies and respective strengths, because they are so contrasting. And Tuchel will want improvement, but I think he'll also be conscious that Argentina pose a very different challenge to Norway. And I think he'll be quietly confident that the issues that England had against Norway will hopefully not be the same when it's a bit cooler in an indoor closed roof stadium. And also some of the challenges that he had to deal with tactically might not be quite so acute against Argentina, or certainly they'll be different in a way that maybe suits England a bit better.
Interesting. Really good there. I'm just going to get your thoughts on the game against Argentina, what England's chances really are, just before we let you go. But let me bring Penty in. And, okay, Penty, just give me a minute. Just give me a second. Let me bring Akumi in on this one, on this very debate about Thomas Tuchel and his seeming, you know, is it disaffection or dissatisfaction with how the players were running, especially the speed, the momentum in the game? Akumi, let me just get your thoughts on that. Is Tuchel being just a little too demanding, or this is typical Tuchel, and this is probably what England need to cross over the line?
I want to take it from two angles. One, it could be that he's doing this to push the team to do more. A psychological aspect of the game where he believes they have enough quality to play better than how they played against the opponent yesterday. But in a nutshell, I think he set up the team to play in that way. And I think this is what the kind of players he selected for the World Cup will be able to give him in terms of the level of technical ability he's expecting from the side. Because you look at the English national team proud to the World Cup, and if you are looking for the top technical midfielders within the setup, you can talk about players like Phil Foden. You can talk about players like Cole Palmer. You can look at players like Kobbie Mainoo, who is not starting games for the English national team at the World Cup. Then in the middle of the pack, he is starting players like Elliot Anderson. Technical ability is there. But for a player like Declan Rice, want to keep possession, break lines, these are players that one or two of them can do it for you, but not on a consistent basis. Then you look at Jude Bellingham. He is more empowered when the team is in transitions, when he needs to bully his way out of a press, when he needs to carry, and when there's a need to score. That is where he comes in. Then you look at his substitutions during the game, then you understand why they played in that manner. And you can't literally blame the playing body, as Jude Bellingham said some other time ago or some few hours ago, that You can't blame them. They did their best. You can't be playing a game. You sub off your midfielder in the shape of Declan Rice. Maintain only one midfielder. Play a double number 10 and expect to dominate possession. It won't happen. It doesn't happen. Against a very good Norway side who have very good players that can keep possession. Martin Odegaard, Sander Berge, These are players that can keep the ball so well. So you don't look at the team, look at your substitutions, come back and blame these players that they are the reason why they did not play well. And I think Thomas Tuchel should have a look at himself if that is what he means. I'm only hoping that he rather means that this team is capable of playing better than what they are doing now. And not because it is the fault of his, and making sure that at the end of the day, they can do better and get their results.
But I mean,
if it is the opposite,
I'm just hearing from the likes of Alan Shearer and a few other former players who heard what Thomas Tuchel say, and they said, look, this is exactly what we want to hear. This is it. This is what we want to hear. We want to hear a coach who's telling the boys that even after you've qualified to the semifinals, to get the boys to feel that, look, it's not enough. It's not enough until we have achieved the ultimate. So where there are still questions to be asked of the team's performance, he's going to raise it. But he's not going to allow the win to sort of just cover up everything and say, well, you know, we did our best, the boys did their best. Some describe it as an honest truth that the boys need. Because, look, they've been at this stage before. They were there in 2018. Unfortunately, they couldn't get over the line. So if you've been able to get here, yeah, it's great you've been able to get here. But let's focus on the things that equally didn't work out right.
I think he also played a part in how the team played. So that is what I'm saying. This is in two aspects. One, he's trying to push them on, work on their mindset, try and make sure that they carry on with performing so well against Argentina and getting a very good result. The other part could also mean that he's literally excusing himself from what happened in the game, where I believe his substitutions nearly cost them in terms of how they could manage their tempo, they could play so fast, they could do a lot of things within the game. And I think you can't also look at Norway and underrate the kind of quality they brought in. Let's just hope that this is something to work on the psyche of these players. If not, they could be in for another trouble. But I think this English team is locked in to do something better under Thomas Tuchel. We've seen how Jude Bellingham reacted to certain criticisms under Thomas Tuchel, where people even felt that he's not supposed to start games for the English national team. You know, Thomas Tuchel is one particular coach who would love to knock down your egos, then remold you and try to build you up and push you further to be in a better position to try and show people that your level of arrogance that you used to play football is in a very positive manner, not in a negative way of undermining the quality of players you are playing with. So I'm just hoping it works in that aspect for England and they try and push for it. They have a very good team to hurt Argentina, a very good team.
Interesting.
They shouldn't be underrated. They shouldn't.
They shouldn't be underrated. Penty, you agree with that? Don't underrate England, because already there are some people who are already seeing Argentina in the final. They are seriously already seeing Argentina in the final, and they are waiting whether it's going to be Argentina, Spain, or Argentina, France. This is like England is not being counted in this equation, Penty.
Hey, are they serious? You can't tell me that. England are a very good team. They have a very good squad to compete and definitely win the ultimate. But if you look at how they've performed at the World Cup so far, I think they haven't met a lot of people, a lot of fans and their expectations of the team. But I think after the draw against the Blasters, they've been able to manage and win every single game since then. And that is the most important thing. Win your game and fight for the ultimate progress and the ultimate result, which is winning the ultimate trophy. So looking at Thomas and his squad, a lot of people complained, and the injuries have set in. These injuries would affect the team, and we can see that it has already started affecting the team, because looking at some of these key players that have gotten injured so far. The player crucial, with James, for example, that right back position, if he was there, they would have played much, much better than they did against Norway. So I just have a feeling that the injury situation in the England camp at the moment is a cause to worry about for Thomas, but we are now in the business end of the tournament. So you wouldn't be able to beat Argentina if you're not at your very best. And Thomas was right, because with the way they played against Norway, it was just a matter of some few decisions that went in their way, because there was a goal that Norway scored. If that goal should have been given, it's game over. If Tolov should have passed that ball to Haaland Elau in the first half, it is 2-1 in the first half. And things could have gone the other way. So I understand where Thomas is coming from. He is right to say that.
Yeah, and I think even the controversy surrounding England's equalizer, you know, the ball apparently hit the cable, and the visuals have shown that indeed it hit the cable, and as to why, you know, the referees didn't even notice that, or VAR didn't intervene in that regard, that's another thing. So maybe that adds to the lucky bit of his interpretation of the game.
It was fine margins, actually fine margins there. It could have gone either way, and I think Thomas Tuchel is right to say that they need to do more. But I just also feel like, as Akumia said, a lot also boils down to him, because you're the head coach, you're the manager. You have to make the right selections. And going to this game, you could see in the second half, he tried to be proactive. But why don't you start from the get-go? Why don't you get... Because it seems there has been too many games where he wants to fight back, he wants to keep it close, he wants to keep it tight. We saw that against DR Congo. It was at the late end of the game before they could get that winner, if not for the brilliance of Harry Kane. They were fighting for their lives against Mexico. It hasn't been smooth for England at this World Cup. So I just think that may be the main reason why a lot of people do not see them as favorites yet. I think that they could just surprise everybody and win it, because they've been to the Euros finals on two occasions, coming back from one just recently where they lost to Spain, and they've been there. They've been close to a lot of these major trophies. So I think they are once again close, and they just need to step up and make it count. I think the likes of Harry Kane, Jude Bellingham, some of these players also need to take responsibility, as we've seen of Jude Bellingham in this tournament. He has taken that responsibility, and taking that responsibility counts, because we could see France, Kylian Mbappe is taking that responsibility. When it comes to Argentina, we know who takes up the responsibility. It's the king of the game. So it's just that we need to see more of these players coming to the party. And I don't see why Tuchel don't give Morgan Rodgers a lot of minutes, or probably we have to see more of Kobbie Mainoo as well. We have to see a lot of these talents at the display, because England cannot do without these players. You might go and face Argentina and the game might stretch to 120 minutes or penalties. You need a lot of players you need more legs in that game. So for me, it's not over yet for any of these teams. You know, football has a lot of surprises for us. Most of the times, some of these teams, if you look at the statistics, for example, Spain have a very good defense. They've considered just a goal at this World Cup. France have considered just two goals. France, even though they've been one of the most prolific teams, they're also good at the back. And that shows that you have to be a well-balanced side to be able to compete. And I think England are a bit shaky in that sense.
Interesting. Well, brilliant there. Let me just get Scott's final submission. He's got to make leave of us and attend to a few other things. But Scott, brilliant. So against Argentina, then there is a France-Spain game. Final thoughts on those semi-finals games. I know, of course, you're British. You'll probably be supporting England to make it to the final. But, you know, just from any position at all, just tell me which teams you think are going to make it to the finals.
I think it'll be England and France, which, as an Englishman, I'd rather it wasn't France. But, I think it'll be England and France. I think Argentina has shown a fallibility this tournament that wasn't there last time. And I think they've... You know, they don't have the same energy that they had last time. They can't press the same way. They haven't got the kind of dynamism and the verticality that they enjoyed at the last tournament. I think they may prove to be a kind of less diverse threat for England than Norway were, even. Not necessarily less threatening, but less diverse. And obviously, that can play into a team's hands. Whereas I think, yeah, and I think the French are just such an extreme talent, such an extremely talented side, particularly in the final third, that I think Spain, for the first time, will find that defence stretched. They will find their defence tested. I think the French are probably just too strong. And I fear for the World Cup final if England are in it and playing for the French. But that's something to think about after the semi-finals.
Well, I mean, you listen to Lamine Yamal and he says, look, if there's anything that can beat this French side, it's Spain. And it appears it's an opinion that is shared by most of the players, that they are so confident that, look, this French team, we are the ones capable of beating them. And I think they might be saying that because of what happened in the Euros. But and the others are also saying that, look, France might have not had the kind of test, the kind of opposition that Spain will give them. The thing is, this is a bit of a stretch, and France might just have it a walk in the park, or this will be a real contest, like real, real, real contest between the two sides.
I think it'll be a tremendous contest because France themselves have shown a few vulnerabilities, particularly defensively. They haven't shown that they're brilliant at winning the ball off teams, and if there's a team that's brilliant at keeping the ball, it's Spain. And so it's the type of match that, you know, we could see the Spanish having huge possession numbers, and then the French having to take risks to try and get the ball off them. But equally, the French, with the quality they have, if they do turn the ball over, they'll be able to threaten Spain in a multitude of ways with some of the tremendous players that they have. I think it's going to be a real battle. And I think that the score of it's a bit cliche, but I think in this one in particular, the score of the first goal will be enormous, because what we've seen so far at this tournament is, unless Spain can utilise Yamal effectively, they do struggle when trying to break teams down who don't have to be ambitious going forwards. And obviously the French, with the amount of quality they have, if they score the first goal and Spain are forced to try and break France down in the low block, the spaces for Mbappe, the spaces for Lisa, the spaces for Dembele just get bigger. And so the team that scores the first goal in this match, I think it has a huge advantage, perhaps even more so than the England-Argentina game, which I can see being much more of a kind of back-and-forward contest, regardless of game state, really. I think the Spain-France game is going to be intriguing, and I'm really looking forward to watching both.
Well, let's see how it all end. If England goes through, then of course we will have some congratulatory message to you, Scott, in heaven. All the best. Thank you very much, Scott. Thank you very much for making time.
Thank you for having me. All the best.
Appreciate it. All the best to you too, Michael. Let me bring you in now on the. Let's just even stay on the Argentine team, though. I mean, just look at how they've made it to the semifinals. It has looked scrappy, and if you look at some of the opposition, it's quite surprising that Argentina have had to struggle in the manner they have. You know, against Switzerland, look, the red card Mbolo picked was a ridiculous dive. Like, what is wrong with you? What is wrong with you? It's what, 60-something minute, you're somewhere around the midfield area and you decide to dive. It's madness for Mbolo, because Switzerland were in control. And Argentina was in a lot of trouble. It's not the first time. We saw it against Cabo Verde. It's not the first time. We saw it against Egypt. And everybody's saying, look, this way Argentina is playing, it will catch up with them. It will catch up with them. That's what everybody I keep saying. It will catch up with them. But strangely, they've always crossed the finish line. They've always managed to cross it. Maybe that's that what being a champion does for you. Regardless of how tough it gets, you find a way to get through. But I don't know. There's a part of me that genuinely feel is not sustainable, that Argentina cannot go on to win the World Cup with this kind of performance. You cannot continue to struggle like that.
Yes, I think there are two things that is really keeping them strong as the competition grows. One is the level of experience they have. They've been able to keep a core part of this team, the team that played in last 4 years World Cup. They still have Cristian Romero as part of this team. They still have Lisandro Martinez. Otamendi started in last 4 years World Cup. He's on the bench. McAllister, Enzo Fernandez. They still have Leandro Paredes. All of these guys were part of the team that played in the World Cup final last 4 years, and they won it. So experience is really counting here. Want to see off games, want to make sure that they don't falter and they allow pressure to eat them up. And secondly, there is Lionel Messi, who always comes into the equation when things get tough. And these are two things that have really, 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 really kept them in such games. And you look at these teams they are playing with, the little mistake they do, Argentina capitalizes on it. The little thing they do, Argentina capitalizes on it. And these are things that are really working in their favor. And I think this is a team that against England, we need to lift their performance beyond reasonable doubt to be able to compete. Because there are certain mistakes that the English national team really do. Just as Kivert, Egypt and Co were doing. Thomas Tuchel, in a nutshell, is a proper knockout coach who believes that whatever he needs to do to get results at any level, he'll do it. So more or less, you can see yesterday's game, when the game was at 2-1, he introduced somebody like Dan Ben. So this is not going to be an English team that will be playing for a red card against you. This is not an English team that will be leading you by 2-1 and will watch you come back, or be leading you by 2-0 and watch you come back 3-2. It's not happening. They will definitely be very compact. They will introduce a lot of players. Thomas Tuchel will know how to kill this game off. But there is one very big concern about this particular Argentine team that they need to address before going into the final games. I don't know if you've realized it. Rangers tend to have very good games against this Argentine side in the last few games. Hassan, Zico, and Doyle yesterday. You look at how the Rangers have been playing so well against these Argentine fullbacks. Then it is something they will need to look at going into the final round of games. And I think this is due to two things. One, I don't think Molina is playing at the top level. And he has always been a weak point for this Argentine team. They are very unfortunate to be missing a player like Medina, who was so solid in the first few games. But injury needed to take him out of the tournament, so he could not continue. Tagliafico comes in and there's a lot of loopholes. So you look at that and you understand that they have a big hole in those two positions, left fullback, right fullback. Then you ask yourself, what Scaloni also does in the starting 11? By starting players like Leandro Paredes, Enzo Fernandez, you are looking at Rodrigo De Paul, five midfielders all starting, two of them playing as wingers. Then you begin to question, how are they going to help the fullbacks? And these are things that have become very problematic for the Argentine national team.
Yeah, it's something I found strange. I see Rodrigo De Paul sometimes playing as a winger. I was like, what is he doing there? Is it that
he wants control, but he's not getting the control, and he must change it. And it has happened in two or three continuous games, and it's not working. And, you know, this is what happens when coaches also become loyal to winning teams. And that is where Carlo Ancelotti found a problem. That is where even Didier Deschamps, in the last 4 years World Cup, he found a problem with Antoine Griezmann. And cool. And you could see these are things that normally hand winners. That the moment they go to certain stages where there's a need for variation, there's a need for a change, they try to stick with the people that have gotten them resources. Sometimes you can't really blame them. And this is what is going to happen against England. They will find themselves in a lot of trouble. Unless Lionel Messi happens, that is how I really see Argentina to overcome the hurdle of this English national team. Because a lot of things they capitalize on from the knockout stages coming, I don't think England will make those mistakes under Thomas Tuchel.
Exactly. No. That's just what I was coming to. But if you look at a coach like Thomas Tuchel, I'm telling you, he is so brilliant that even in the course of the game, he has the ability to make these variations that can punish you. I think as big as Argentina is, Thomas Tuchel has got a really, really good team that is willing to work hard, that is equally will also not make some of the mistakes the likes of Egypt, the likes of Switzerland.
No. Because England wouldn't lead you by 2 goals and watch you come away by 3 goals.
It's not going to happen.
You won't have the opportunity to do that.
Mm-hmm.
England will be playing with very cautious mindsets. Yesterday, can you imagine if Bellingham played with a yellow card for 120 minutes or 115 minutes? Very difficult. So these guys have literally tuned and turned on as the competition goes. So don't expect another red card to be coming in. And this is a team that when they are leading by 2-1, don't think that it's easy to grind out. So that is what I'm saying, that unless Lionel Messi happens, that is how I say it.
Mm-hmm.
Unless Lionel Messi happens, mm-hmm. He's that guy.
Yeah.
Unless it happens.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, there's no way you can legislate for him. There's nothing that can contain him in a game. He will look like he's just walking around. He's not doing much. But one pass from him, one cross from him can make the difference. And Penty, is there another thing you have also observed of this Argentine team that you think needs improving going into that game against England?
I think Acuña is right. Molina is a liability to the team. We saw the Real Viedo kid. I think he really make good use of that flanks. Hassan, if I'm right, he was torturing him on the flanks with Tagliafico. We saw Mohamed Salah also going at the fullbacks, and they were very, very poor in that game against Egypt. And last night as well, they faced similar problems. And you could clearly see that they haven't been able to solve that. It is a problem that they even faced in the first game against Algeria, where Algeria scored, but a goal was disallowed. So this is one thing they need to work on. But as you guys said, if Lionel Messi happens, they just get away with some of these things. And I think, fortunately for them as well, they have two center backs that contribute to goals. So, in the game against Cape Verde, Lisandro Martinez scored, and we also saw Christian Romero scoring as well. So, these players contribute to goals when it matters most. When the other players are not even scoring, the front line are not scoring, they come to the party. Yesterday, Julian Alvarez scored his first goal at the World Cup, and it was a brilliant goal, a very, very good goal. I think that goal will give him a lot of confidence and will prepare him into the game against England, looking to continue or add to his tally. But that being said, you cannot take anything away from England. England are a very good side. The problem I think England has at the moment is that they have a lot of injuries, and maybe the game has reached a point where they need to bring in certain players and they will not have them available. And that may be an issue for England. But if the game stretches beyond 120 minutes, that is when you just know that Argentina would make it in and win it, because that is where they are. Because so far, all the knockout games have gone to extra time, if I'm not mistaken. Okay, maybe the one against Egypt went into late of the 90th minute, but they just know how to win it at the very last end. So I think England will just have to do their job as early as possible. Take your chances like Egypt did and close shop.
Well, let's see if that can
work. Yeah, so
Yeah. Brilliant.
But let's talk about France.
Let's talk about France. Yeah, France, Spain, though. Let's talk about France. Yeah.
Because that game is going to be interesting, because I believe the winner of that game is going to win the World Cup.
A lot of people have been saying that. There's a lot of talk about that. That is going to be Spain or France winning the World Cup. You know, why is that so? Is it because of their performance so far?
Yes, you look at Spain. Until they face Belgium, they haven't conceded a goal. And that's really that they have a good defense. However, you could also see France, they just conceded just two goals at the tournament. So both teams are going to the semifinals with one of the best defense at the tournament so far. And you look at France, they have Kylian Mbappe, who has scored the most goals at this year's FIFA World Cup. Kylian goes with Lionel Messi. And you could see the unity in the team that they're playing for this guy. Olise plays for him, Dembele plays for him. There's this unity in the team. And that unity can propel them to win it this time around. But if you look at the Spain setup itself, they don't depend on individual players like France do. Even though France have a lot of quality out front, they solely depend on Kylian Mbappe for most of the goals. But a tactical switch from Luis de la Fuente brings in Mikel Merino later on, and he gets a goal. He done it twice so far in the tournament. And it has worked. It worked against Portugal. It worked against Belgium. So those tactical switches could play a huge advantage in Spain's favor. So this is going to be a really, really tight encounter. We don't even know who's going to win it. But I just think that France have that quality. They have the quality up front. Because I just feel like Nicole Oyarzabal, Lamine Yamal, and maybe Nico Williams, if he comes on, or Alex Baena, haven't done enough up front for Spain. They hardly get a goals. They find it difficult to score goals. And that may be something that would affect them in this game. That would be their downfall. Maybe that may be the reason why they might not make it to the final. Yeah.
I think, look, one of the things I've also identified with the Spanish team is that, especially the game against Belgium, clearly Belgium struggled a bit, but the point when Lukaku was introduced into the game, I think that's when even Spain relaxed much more, because Lukaku, all he could do was get the long balls to him, let's see if he can hold up the ball, and then allows the likes of Di Cattler to be able to make the runs in between, or Doku to be able to do that. But all of that was off. I think Belgium looked even better when Lukaku was not on the field, allowing Di Cattler to make those runs and try and put pressure on Kubasi and co. I mean, against, I think they played Portugal. Against Portugal, we saw that Ronaldo was pretty much ineffective. The Belgium defense were not worried as much as, people will want to see. Kubasi and Laporte were literally pushing forward. For most of the time, they were spending, a chunk of their time somewhere in the center circle or deep in the opponent half. They were not being troubled a lot. But against France, that is where you see these two guys having to work a lot, because Dembele, Michael Olise, even Kylian Mbappe, the kind of runs these guys will be making behind the defensive line will put Kubasi and Laporte, Marc Laporte, under lots of pressure. And I think that this is the kind of game that Spain have been waiting for, the kind of game they've been waiting for and they've been wary of, because they know that Kubasi can be good, but he's not. He can be found wanting sometimes. Even Laporte can be found wanting sometimes. And I think the pace and the quality of the likes of Dembele, Olise, and Kylian Mbappe will put this Spanish defense under lots of tests. And this record of having conceded just one goal so far in this tournament just might be broken.
I think this is interesting, looking at how this game can pan out. But the trump card is going to be around Michael Olise. How he's going to link the midfield and attack is really going to be very important. And you look at the center backs of France, how they'll be able to locate the runs of players like Desiré Doué, Kylian Mbappe, and Ousmane Dembele. It's all about winning your individual draws and individual battles. The Spanish national team will come in, they will look to dominate possession. Rodri has been fantastic in this World Cup. 62 line-breaking passes, absolutely brilliant. So he's a player that the French national team will really need to be locked in. And this is a Spanish team that you shouldn't try locking in players like Pedri, locking in players like Lamine Yamal, locking in players like Oyarzabal. These are not the players you should lock in. Trust me. If there are certain key players you really need to lock in to prevent this Spanish national team from doing a lot, you have to first of all look at Rodri. Second, you have to look at a player like Dani Olmo within the setup, the way he drops deep, the way he works so hard, then Pau Kubasi. The reason why these three players play a crucial role is the ability to play certain passes that could penetrate through your first line of press, your second line of press, and even get to an attacker. You saw what Kubasi did many a times against Belgium. Even on a yellow card, he picks up a pass to Lamine Yamal, and you ask yourself a lot of questions. So this is one player you need to look out for. Then Rodri, I've already spoken about. Then Dani Olmo, dropping deep to pick up these balls, moving into dangerous positions just to pull opponents away from where they are supposed to stand, just to give space to players like Fabian Ruiz or even Mikel Merino, who are much faster. So these are things the French national team will need to look up to. If they should go and focus on the likes of Lamine Yamal and co, they are really going to be in trouble. These are individual matches where I believe Theo Hernandez and Co should be able to handle it. But I think for players like Kubasi, Rodri, Dani Olmo, that is where the real job is. They need to work extremely hard. They need to really work hard. And I think why Spain should also be careful about this Spanish national team will have to be about the quality of players they have on the bench. Belgium lost the game from the bench. France will not lose the game from the bench. That is the two difference.
Portugal lost the game. Is it France? Is it Portugal lost the game from the bench?
Yes.
Because they could not do quality changes from the bench. Belgium lost the game from the bench because there was Romelu Lukaku and Co. But this is a French national team that when you look at their bench, you can't even think about them losing the game from the bench.
Bakola can come on and produce some magic. Rianche.
N'Golo Kanté is even yet to play a single minute at this World Cup.
Indeed, yet to play a single minute at this World Cup.
Zaire Emery played, I think, 30 minutes and he hasn't played again.
Mm.
Marcus Thuram is here to kick a ball.
Mm. I mean,
this is a team that can do a lot of things.
Yeah, when it gets critical, he can even throw in Mateta to come and just frustrate Kubasi and Laporte.
Come and frustrate Kubasi and
allow Kylian Mbappe to just be free and make the runs.
So the difference between this French national team in 2024 and what has been happening in the past few years is this French team is more stacked with players that can change the game from the bench.
Mm.
They are stacked with that. Now look at the kind of impact Bakola and Desire Odoi has had on this team in terms of each one of them coming from the bench.
Yeah, it's been brilliant.
Then you look at Manu Kone in placement for Tchouaméni.
Kone is
this is a team that I think if the Spanish national team is going in and thinking that you've beaten them three times, they should look at themselves in the mirror again. And this is the World Cup.
Mm-hmm.
Their coach is probably leaving after this tournament.
Mm.
There's a lot to play for. And they've really locked in. Their form is at the right. This is not to say Spain can't beat them. I'm not saying that.
Yeah, yeah.
But I'm only trying to say it is really going to be a little bit dull to think that because they beat them in the Nations League and it is this French national team, Spain is going to swallow them up. They need to have a second look because this is a Spanish team that can play 120 minutes with quality for quality in any position.
That's really insightful, really insightful. Well, Lawrence Bedu has just joined us now. He is joining me for the last part of the conversation on our women's football. But Lawrence, let me just get your quick thoughts on the, that cracker on Tuesday between Spain and France. And guys, the final part of the conversation will have to be about officiating in this tournament, especially going to the semifinals. I mean, I don't know if FIFA is doing a constant review of the performance of the officials, but especially in the semifinals, a lot of things have got to improve when it comes to officiating. And even when it comes to the point where VAR intervenes, a lot of things have got to improve because the semifinal is a very sensitive stage. It's a very sensitive stage. If you look at the teams involved, I mean, you can't afford to make any mistake. You can't afford to allow some fouls to go unpunished and others to be punished and all of that. You can't allow any suspicion of bias to unfold in the semi-final when France and Spain is playing and when England and Argentina is playing. So that's the last part of the conversation I'm going to have with Akumi and Penti. But Lawrence, let me just get your thoughts on that game between France and Spain. What are you expecting?
Look, these are probably the two most informed national teams as far as this competition is concerned. If you look at what Akomiya mentioned, the quality in that French side is a second to none. They have players off the bench, players in the starting lineup. And the interesting thing about Didier Deschamps has to be the fact that he can call on anybody from the bench to come and just see the trajectory of this game or of their games. You saw what Bakola and Dwe has been doing, playing interchangeably. You saw anytime that Ryan Cherki has been one of the star men for Manchester City. He's come to this tournament, has not even been able to grasp as many minutes as he would have anticipated heading into this competition. So it tells you the kind of quality French have, the French team has. But if you look at the Spanish side, and in as much as they've not really got things taken, they've had the results in their way. They've played collectively as a team. Some of their individual brilliance have not been to the party yet, but they've been able to grind out results. They've been able to manage games, see out some of the challenges that many were expecting that would be a stumbling block for them. So it's going to be a very good game. My suspicion is that they would want to keep the ball for as long as they can just to frustrate the French side. But then again, the French have workaholics. people who are really good working off the ball in the middle of the area. Manu Kone, Rabiot, these two have been machines. For Rabiot, many didn't really see this coming. Look, his performance in the Serie A, and anytime he's been out of action for AC Milan, you can clearly tell there's been something missing. So it's a very good game to look forward to. My point of view would have to be how fluid that France would have to be anytime they are in transition. How fluid those spaces Michael Olise can find them. How fluid Kylian Mbappe will make those runs to free up certain players to take advantage of. So it's such an interesting game to look forward to. If you look at the Spanish side as well, they'll be hoping that Nico Williams, for everything he's been through from last season through to this tournament, could be able to give them something productive. Because look, the Spain team relying on just Lamine Yamal has become problematic, and in times where he's been found out, it's not really been brilliant for them. It's not really gone their way, but they have those individual players who don't necessarily have to score goals but make impact. Akomiya mentioned Robby, he mentioned Paco Bassi. You saw how that winner against Belgium came up. These are areas, key areas that could decide the game. If they're able to sort out some of these technicalities in their game, we should be up for a good game.
Well, let's see if they can sort it out. But Penty, just a bit on the officiating. There have been too many questions, especially in the quarterfinals. The England goal that they equalised, just strange why VAR decided not to intervene in it. Really strange, really, really strange. And then in terms of the Embolo second yellow card, of course, yeah, deserving the yellow card, the dive was completely acceptable. But then people make reference to some other decisions that VAR decided not to intervene in a case of a second yellow card, you know, and you wonder why VAR chooses to intervene in certain instances and they choose not to intervene in certain instances. Even in that England game, the Konsa clearance, if you look at the contact he made, I think, on Erling Haaland, some said, well, why didn't VAR even look at it? I mean, there's been genuine questions about officiating so far in this tournament. If you want to see something improved as far as officiating is concerned, based on what you observed in the quarterfinals, what are the things you hope FIFA will be paying attention to?
I think the concerns are valid if you look at where it's coming from. Right, the England game, for example, that ball that fell to Gordon, in that instance, it's just bad from FIFA not to review that, because it's just unacceptable. You can, because the goalkeeper complained about it. It's not like he complained about it. In that same instance, he complained about it. So I think some of these things, I just think it favors the big teams or the teams that are the favorites in some of these games. But going to the semifinals, you don't have any clear favorites anymore, right? So in the game against England and Norway, England were favorites. Now we are playing, England plays Argentina, and there is no clear favorite. So they have to work on some of these decisions and also officiating. But overall, I don't think it's that bad, like how people are trying to create it or try to come to a sense that the World Cup has been rigged, or, you know, it's not that bad to that extent. Because
The whole questions about the integrity of the competition and all of that, you think it's just a bit extreme?
It's just been a bit exaggerated, you know. So, in my opinion, I don't think it's that really, really bad. But some 50-50 decisions that have to go in favor of maybe the less favorite team goes in favor of the other team, which is the favorite team. So people may decide to read meanings into it as to how they see it. But these 50-50 decisions can go either way. But looking at what we've seen so far this tournament, I think some of these outrage has just been outrageous. Like, it's just been exaggerated in terms of officiating. That being said, there has to be a lot that needs to be worked upon. VAR has to come in when necessary. And we've seen a lot of times at this tournament where VAR have been ignored totally.
For example, in the game against Egypt and Argentina, that game, VAR was ignored. Ghana's game against England, VAR was ignored. We don't want to see that in the semifinals. Because in the game against England, for example, the penalty that was given to England, if it was not reviewed, that would have been a penalty. So, so a similar incident that happened where the Egyptian guy found that Argentinian, and we got that first penalty of the game, that first goal equalizer for Argentina, that could have been reviewed. It wasn't reviewed. So I just think it's just fine margins, 50-50 margins for both teams where it could go either way, that they just need to review it or just make a better decision. And that would bring down all this outrage of the World Cup being rigged or the integrity of the tournament being disrepute or something like that. But if you look at what we've seen so far, it is not far from what we've seen at club levels, or it's not far from what we've seen week in, week out in the Champions League or in the Premier League. You can see more controversial decisions in the Premier League, but it's just that it's a World Cup and a lot is at stake. So there's going to be a lot of people criticizing every single decision that the referee makes. But going to the semifinals, I think it is two big teams going at each other, and there is nothing that could be made to favor any of these teams. So they just have to make the right course, check VAR when necessary, and also the players have to also conduct themselves, because most of the time you put the blame to the officials, but the players have to also conduct themselves. We saw what Embolo did against Argentina. That was unnecessary. Just making your team lose a game and costing your team that red card means that you're going to put your team in a big, big, more dangerous situation where they cannot come back and win the game. And they might go and lose the game, and people will start saying Argentina got favored by the referee. But you were the cause of it. So some of these decisions on and on the pitch, talking to the minds of the referees, trying to provoke them, because there's a lot that is out there about this official. I just think that the narrative is far off. The World Cup has gone so far so smoothly, from being, in my opinion, officiating hasn't been that bad, and it's not the worst that we've seen in football.
I mean, Akumen, do you agree with that? Do you agree with that? A lot of the concerns about officiating and the fact that maybe the teams that are in the semifinals now, that is what FIFA wanted to happen, and so they orchestrated it, and you know, he thinks it's just a bit of an exaggeration. You buy into that?
If FIFA orchestrated it, I'll be very surprised, because how can FIFA orchestrate a killer like what Julian Alvarez scored yesterday? And it's really going to be very funny. I think the big problem we've had in this World Cup is the level of consistency when it comes to decisions by referees. You see in one game, this decision is taken against an opponent. You see in a different game, the decision is upheld. These are the things a lot of people are complaining about that have eaten into the fact that people think this World Cup has been rigged in favor of certain national teams to get to certain levels. And I think you wouldn't get 100% from refereeing decisions. But this time around, with the help of semi-automated offsides, you are looking at the VAR working extremely hard, the introduction of rules like mistaken identity, which went against Embolo yesterday. I think we need to be consistent with a lot of decisions going into the semifinal. So if you see a decision go against somebody in the France-Spanish game, we need to see the same decision go against another person in the game against England and Argentina. That is all that people are asking for. Equity. It's important we look at those things.
Equity. Interesting. And just finally, though, FIFA is thinking about a 64-team tournament. We've seen a 48-team tournament. Is FIFA just being greedy, or they just want to, you know, be more inclusive?
I think Infantino is trying to play the game on his behalf or towards himself. He's being greedy in this regard. Anything that will get him votes, that is what he's doing.
because a lot of these member associations will feel like this is the best opportunity to also participate in the World Cup and get a lot of money. So the opening it up to 64, they'll be interested. But in as much as they are becoming so many, we are losing the touch and the quality of the tournament. That is what we need to look at. What makes the World Cup exceptional is its quality, not the number. And how scarce it is. For 4 years, you need to prepare before you come in. Not in a lot of games, though. So at first, you needed to win 7 to 8 games to win the World Cup. Now you need to play around 8 to 9 games to win the World Cup. Then in the future, you want us to play like 10 games or 12 games to win the World Cup. I think this is more of a selfish interest for Infantino rather than the quality of the competition.
But
he says
it's a World Cup. If it's a World Cup, then we should create a situation where...
It is a World Cup. That is why we play qualifiers.
There are some teams that will never get to play the World Cup. Why?
And that is to them because if it is qualifiers, you need to play at your utmost best to qualify. We've seen Kevin come to the World Cup for the first time. We've seen Kurisao come to the World Cup for the first time. That has not been at the World Cup, no matter how good we were.
But that only happened because he was 48. And maybe that happens, countries like Zambia can get a chance to also play the World Cup when you make it 64.
Musbao, it was 48, but Italy didn't qualify. We've seen top nations that did not qualify for the World Cup, including Cameroon.
And you don't miss Italy at the World Cup?
I don't miss them. It was 48 and Nigeria did not even qualify for the World Cup. So you see nations that have not qualified for the World Cup. Poland and Denmark did not come to the World Cup. We can say Chile did not come to the World Cup. It is about the quality of the competition, not the quantity. I think 48 is enough. We've gone to the 48, which have established something very good. It is enough. And I think FIFA is trying to use this to play with politics and then get things into his side. No. This is really, how can you cover a World Cup? Even from the journalistic point of view, how do you expect journalists to cover a World Cup where there will be games played in Argentina, there will be games played in Uruguay, there will be a game played in Paraguay, then fast forward, we are here to Spain, Morocco, but how? How?
I mean, you will make more money if there are more games, isn't it? I mean, and you probably...
So he criticized UEFA for putting in, or the likes of Florentino Perez and Co. for pushing for the Super League, but they are doing the same things.
Well, because they are seriously exploring. I wouldn't be surprised if we end up with it, and I will not be surprised.
I've always said something that was about football is not an honest game. Every single person involved in football is doing something one way or the other for a selfish interest.
Mm-hmm.
So let's see how this thing works out.
Interesting. And Penty, you were saying something that, well, that's why they are qualifiers. I mean, you should allow... Okay, he's gone off. Anyway, Lawrence, just you want to have a bite on this one. 64, you two, you are not happy with the increase. You don't want to see Nigeria and Ghana play at the World Cup. You know, Nigeria... If
not necessarily about not wanting to see Nigeria or Ghana at the World Cup. I think that Akomiya hit the nail right on his foot, on his head. You play qualifiers, right? You want to see the best of football. If you're not at your utmost best during the qualifiers, what guarantees are that we would see you at your utmost best during the World Cup itself? That is where the issue is. At 48 teams, you are seeing the loads on the players. You are seeing how expensive it's becoming to cover the World Cup, even from the journalistic point of view. We want to see the quality of football at display. We want to see the highest of stars. Akubia mentioned the fact that it's 48 teams. We are not seeing Nigeria, we are not seeing Italy, we are not seeing Chile, we are not seeing Denmark. These are people who play with huge quality, and they were not able to qualify to the tournament because they were not at their ultimate best.
But look at what participation for countries like Curacao, countries like Haiti.
Yeah.
Look at what participation did for the country and the people. So why don't you give opportunity for other countries to also experience the fun, the joy of playing.
Yeah, then again, it boils down to how good you are during qualifiers. I don't think if Curacao were that bad, they make it to the tournament. Another country would have made it.
Even when it's 64, there will still be qualifiers. And there are some teams that will get the opportunity to play.
That is no. The thing is, it's 48. We are seeing how stressful it's becoming to see players play day in day out. you're looking at the number of injuries you are suffering as the tournament progresses. And this is not because, this is because there's too much workload on the players playing for from the season and then straight into the World Cup season. No rest. And to add more of these games to it, I'm sorry, as well, this is more fun, a personal interest than what the world is looking for.
I mean, because Penty, there's this other argument that countries like Ghana, countries like England, countries like Belgium, they are regulars at the World Cup. So when a conversation about a 64-team tournament comes up, because they are regulars at the tournament, so they feel like, nah, don't touch my place at the World Cup. Don't burden me too much. But there are countries like Zimbabwe, Tanzania, you can talk about China, you can talk about India, who will be looking at an opportunity like this as one that is golden and hopefully they might just be at the World Cup, something they've been waiting for a long time.
Yeah, but to be honest with you, these countries also participate and compete with this so-called favorites to be at the World Cup for the sports. So the favorites that you are mentioning also have to compete for the sports. It's not like the sports is their birthright, okay? Italy is not at the World Cup. We've seen the rise of Chile, as Akumia mentioned. And there's a lot of countries. Togo made their first World Cup appearance in 2006. They have to fight for it. Togo, a small nation in West Africa, had to fight for that spot. And it means so much to that country when they have to fight for it with the big boys. Okay? So it's when it's not handed to that nation on a silver platter, it means even more to them.
But Penty, when you say when it's not handed to that nation on a silver platter, it's not going to be handed to them on a silver platter. They will also have to play qualifiers, except that the slots will increase in the case of Africa. Yeah. Now we've got like nine
automatic
slots.
The qualifiers will be easier to play.
No, so it's not going to be easier. How will you say it's easier?
Take for instance, a country like Cape Verde, what it means to play at the World Cup for the very first time. Yeah. Imagine they become regulars. You don't get the same sense of excitement. You have to work
Ghana,
for it. You
Ghana
have to
has
roll.
Played at the World Cup since 2006, the exception of 2018. Has it really watered down the excitement of playing at the World Cup? It hasn't. We've been at the World Cup since 2018, and every time we've been at the World Cup, it has always been filled with excitement. There's never been a point where we feel that, oh no, like, you know, we've got to use of the World Cup. Nobody ever gets used to the World Cup.
Yeah, but as time goes on and we become regulars at the World Cup, when it's a 60-man team, you expect Ghana to be there. Or a 60-team tournament, you expect Ghana to be there.
Obviously.
Right?
Obviously.
Exactly.
Obviously.
Yeah, so you expect Ghana to be there. And the qualification path become more and more easier because maybe Africa may have 15 sports or 16 or up to even 20 sports at the World Cup. We don't know. But the more the teams, the more the qualification part becomes easier. Before, you have to play a group stage, then qualify for the playoffs. Then after the playoffs, before you can book a place at the tournament. And that even that playoffs, we saw against Nigeria, where we went there, the kind of excitement that was around it, because definitely getting to that playoffs alone is an achievement on the continent. And meeting Nigeria, which is a major rival, and beating them to qualify for the World Cup was even a bigger achievement for the Black Stars of Ghana. So what I mean is that if these so-called smaller nations want to be at the World Cup, they have to fight for it.
But they
have to fight for it with the big boys. If Cape Verde is able to beat Cameroon in the same group to make it to the World Cup, then Zimbabwe, Zambia also have to work hard and beat the likes of Ghana, South Africa, Cote d'Ivoire, Egypt to the World Cup. And that will even mean more for them, because after they make it to the World Cup, even if they don't win any match at the World Cup, they will have party in their country like Cape Verde is doing now. You get it? The excitement of just qualifying to the World Cup will mean a lot. But if it is just handed, you have to just play Eswatini and Somalia and you are true to the World Cup. What excitement comes with beating Eswatini and Somalia and you are in the World Cup? There's no excitement that comes to it. You want to beat Egypt and be at the World Cup, and that birthright of being there alone, or that chance of being there by beating Egypt, is the excitement that we see. And the country being there alone would bring joy to the people in the country.
But if you talk about the excitement of beating Egypt, will anything pass the excitement of beating Egypt at the World Cup?
go and meet Egypt at the World Cup and beat them at the World Cup? Will anything pass that? And if you ask any team, I think they will prefer beating Egypt at the World Cup to progress than beating them at the qualifiers to get to the World Cup. Yes, let's all go to the World Cup and we'll beat them at the World Cup and progress to the next stage. You think teams wouldn't love
when
that?
When Ghana beat Panama, right?
Mm.
And when Ghana drew against England, which game gave you the most excitement?
Both.
Zach? No. The way we drew against England, even though we didn't play well, even though we didn't win the game, the excitement was higher than the excitement we got when we beat Panama. You get it? What it means to face England and even draw had more excitement than beating Panama, because it is Panama. You're expected to beat Panama. You get it? That is what football is about. People want to meet the big boys and fight with them. So what we've seen at this year's World Cup can tell the story. Egypt facing Argentina. The excitement they got in that first half alone, it's because it's Argentina. They're playing against the big boys. So that is how football works. We are talking about emotion, passion, the excitement. And if you can get this, we have to then reduce the number of teams at the World Cup. You can only do that because in this life, there's nobody that's going to get like ultimate opportunity. Djibouti can never make it to the World Cup. Even if you make it 100 teams or 100, Djibouti does not have the resources to play at the World Cup. Somalia, AFCON, they haven't qualified before. You want to qualify for World Cup. You get it. These countries can, even AFCON, even the AFCON that they've expanded. Somalia has to be in a group with Ivory Coast and Ghana to book a spot there. And you want to qualify for World Cup. It's just...
Fair enough. I understand you.
That's not interest for Infantino.
Well, let's see how all of that progress. And... France, Spain on Tuesday, 7 p.m., and then England, Argentina on Wednesday, 7 p.m. But let's just touch a bit on women's teams who have been in some really good form this year, and also you want to add last year into it as we wrap up the show today. And I'm just looking at the record there. The women under 15 side, the Black Damsels, they managed to win the Africa Schools Championships, back-to-back victories there. Then for the Black Maidens, they've now qualified for the under 17 Women's World Cup yesterday after beating Senegal on penalties. Then the Black Princess, they have already also qualified for the 2026 under 20 Women's World Cup happening in Poland. And the Black Queens, they are currently even in Morocco, having qualified for the WAFCON, and also looking to book their place in the 2027 FIFA Women's World Cup in Brazil. I mean, Lawrence, it's been a really good run for the women's national team. But for the Black Queen, for the under-20 team, this hasn't come as a surprise, has it? I think maybe the Black Maidens, who have had to suffer some, it was a ban for a while, their return has been massive, hasn't it? Yeah, I can hear you, Lawrence. Let me hear from you.
Yeah, I think I lost you for a moment in the last part of your presentation.
Yeah, I was saying that for the Black Queens and the under-20 team, their performance is not so much of a surprise, but particularly for the under-17, if you look at what they have had to go through in recent years following that ban, their bounce back, if you want to describe it, has been really good. They have stood out. But in general, women's football has done well.
Obviously, it has. Kudos to everyone who has played a role in it. Look, it's an intentional process to get the women's football up to this point. And I'm going to take it from, the last 3 or 4 years that we've seen this GFA administration, as far as women's football is concerned. They've done their business very well. As far as the WAFCON is concerned, Ghana had not been there since we've seen it in 2018. missed the 2022 edition, returned for the 2024 edition, was played last year. For the Black Princesses, as you mentioned, there's been no cause for alarm. They've been there for 8 times and they're going there for the 9th time. The issue was with the Black Maidens, where they suffered that ban in 2022 for 8 seasons, which means that they missed the last 2 editions of the Women's U17 World Cup. And the trick is this. After that ban came in, it was how they were going to get back into the world stage, how Ghana was going to build from them. And that is where the U15 came in. So that tournament, the U15 African Football Championship, CAF Schools Football Championship, was introduced at the right time because it gave Ghana the platform to build onto something, identify young talents who can be progressed from the U15 level to the E17 level. If you look at the E17 level that secured qualification to the 2026 World Cup yesterday, it has about 6 to 7 players who have played with the U15 team. It has players who played in the very first edition of the UGFA's Elite U15 tournament, which was staged in Pram Pram. So it's a developmental stage that was, or developmental process that was very intentional from the GFA to get the girls going, to integrate them into it very early and avoid the stage which they were some 4 years ago, which led to Ghana being banned when we faced Morocco. It's the consistency. And even for them, but for the ban, it would have been no issue at all. They've been at the World Cup 6 times already before yesterday's 7. So it's the more like a stage you expect them to be as far as qualifiers are concerned. Face Togo, dispatch them, face Liberia, made very little of that contest. And then that tricky encounter against Senegal. Look, if anyone wants to downplay the Senegalese side, they play. This is a Senegalese side that has been very, very compact, very disciplined as far as their qualifiers is concerned. Their women's football trying to progress it every now and then. And if we watch that game in the first leg, which was even more troubling than the one they played at Accra Sports Stadium, the Senegalese side looked very much matured. They looked very disciplined, well coached. And so they gave the U17 side, the Black Maidens, a whole lot of trouble until the penalties came in. So it's a constant, intentional plan from the GFA to get the women's football going forward. Some of these girls who are playing for the U17 are even with the U20. So it tells you the structure in place to develop these girls from one stage to another, give them time to grow, and then you can integrate them into other areas of the national team. So it's been a good year for women's football in this country.
It's been a really good year indeed, and the development has been impressive, even as far as the club level has been really good. And Penty, I mean, you just heard Lawrence, they're alluding to some of the work that the FA has done as far as making sure that women's football is able to pick up, and the result from that has been very impressive. And I think it's one thing that the FA understandably deserve massive credit for. And you know, despite a lot of the backlash that they've suffered for the Black Stars performance and even the state of the Ghana Premier League and some other aspect of our game, when it comes to women's football, they deserve the plaudits, don't they?
They do deserve a lot of it, but it's just that as a country you haven't paid much attention to it, and that is why we need a lot of investment in our grassroots football in terms of women's leagues in this country. The Women's Premier League needs a lot of investment because they are doing well. So the moment you pay more attention, you give them the right resources, the right investment, we'll see more, and then we can conquer Africa, we can conquer the world. That is what I want GFA to strategize and to build a network of investors where they can push and pump a lot of money into our women's football, because the talent is there. We are seeing a really, really good growth in terms of even from the lower division. The Black Damsels did a back-to-back. I covered their tournament in Ghana here. It was amazing how they were the only team that gave us a good tournament, because we did a host and win in that African Schools Football Championship. If not because of their performance, I think we would have received a big shame there, because the under 15 boys team didn't do well. So you could see the progress even from the under 15, under 17, under 20, And now we are seeing the Black Queens also do well, finish third, won bronze at the last AFCON. This time around, they're looking to make it probably to the World Cup. The World Cup is a major task or the major goal for the team at the moment. And if they make it to the World Cup, it's another big achievement for Ghana, because it's been a long time the Black Queens have made it to a World Cup, even though we've seen that of the under 20 and under 17. So it is a good progress. I just want us to maintain it, and for us to maintain the progress and for us to see the consistent growth into the future, you have to do the right form of investment, and you have to start talking about it more. As journalists, you also have a role to play. The likes of Lawrence have and others have done a great job covering the women's game, but I think a lot have to go into it. There have to be a lot of media coverage as well, because the leagues are doing well. The Division 1 League of the Women's Premier League is doing well. The Premier League is also doing well. So let's give them the right facelift. Let's put them out there. Let's tell people about the good things they're doing. Yesterday, they qualified for the World Cup. And then I see nothing is going on in this country. Like a normal feat. But if it was a men who qualified for a World Cup, we would have been talking about it. The men went to Africa and failed to qualify for the World Cup. They went to play the African Cup of Nations, which is under 17 men, and they failed to qualify for the World Cup. So it is a big achievement for the Black ladies.
Yeah, congratulations.
And we just need to... Congratulations to them.
Yeah, great. Lawrence, in wrapping up, though, how can we sustain this? In fact, just even before the idea of sustaining it, they've qualified now. We know what the Black Queens have had to go through in the lead up to the AFCON. I don't know in the last 3 months if they got any, top level friendly game to play in terms of their preparations for the AFCON. Let's talk about them briefly in terms of their preparation for the AFCON and realistically how well they could do, because that's what is upcoming. That the AFCON is in July, right? July.
Yeah,
July. That's.
I mean, it starts
this month. I mean,
in 2 weeks' time. Yeah,
absolutely. In terms of how the team has prepared, because qualification is one thing, then preparation is another thing. We qualified, and the team's preparation sometimes it is unbelievable. And the Black Queens, if you want to be very objective about how they've prepared for the tournament, what would be your assessment?
Well, I think as far as preparations is concerned, if I'm to rate it on a scale of 10, I'll probably say a 6. Look, after qualifying back in October, the only game, high-profile game they had to play was that friendly against England. And then from there, they moved into camp in February, which was